Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit.
Summer's nearly over, and kids are back in school. College dorms are full, and the students are filling up on beer before the classes get too tough. There's a tinge of fall in the air as well. The harvest is coming in, and it seems like there's going to be a frost any night now, depending on if this warm weather holds. As we reunite with the routines of fall, we ask each other, what did you do this summer? It's a repeat of that first school assignment of the year, an essay titled, What I Did on My Summer Vacation. That question's the inspiration for today's Yin Radio show about traveling. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio. And we're talking about summer travel and noting that the Earth may be big, but it's not so lonely. It's the Not So Lonely Planet show today on Yin Radio.
Get out the map, and lay your finger anywhere down. We'll leave the figure into those we pass on our way out of town. We'll drink the water, there seems to be something ailing everyone. I'm gonna clear my head, I'm gonna drink that sun. I'm gonna love you good and strong.
Let's start our travels today by going back home. Installment number one's about going home and seeing it anew, like seeing it for the first time, like seeing it with someone else's eyes. I used to travel quite a bit for my work. I was a university fundraiser, and fundraisers go where the donors are. I kept mostly to the west, with the heaviest concentration of travel near home in Washington and Idaho. But I also got out to D.C., to Florida, and points in between at least a couple times a year. I never expected to enjoy travel so much, but especially not travel to Florida. It's my home. I left my native Florida to come to Idaho. It was a bold leap of faith for me, a drastic change of scenery, and I had no evidence I could live with it. But I was ready to escape Florida. See, Florida is so hot that it burns my really paper-white skin. It makes me break out in itches, and if the sun's not too bold, the mosquitoes are going to cause itching instead. That flat, bare ground, it's a dull shade of sand. It's unbroken by changes in elevation. Even the trees seem stumped and beaten by the dullness of days without change. Always hot, always bright, always the same. This is the Florida that I escaped. I never thought I would enjoy visiting Florida so much as I do, now that I've found Idaho to be my true home. I arrived in Moscow on August 16th in the heat of summer and was baffled by the cool evenings here. In Florida, when it got up to 80 degrees, you know, those cool days of fall or spring when it only got up to 80, when the night fell, the temperature would plunge to, what, 70, sometimes 65? Here things are really different. So it was August. I'm in Idaho. And it not only stayed down to a comfortable 80-some-odd degrees for the high temperature, but it really and truly did plunge after sunset. It got downright cold to this Floridian. I wore turtlenecks in part of August and pretty much all of September, even though most people around me were wearing short sleeves and shorts. The day that I arrived in Idaho, Lydia showed me around campus. I was totally in her care, as I had no car, no house, no bearings, no nothing. Lydia was to be my secretary, but Probably Mother would have described her role better. Lydia is an Idaho native. She's from Preston, Idaho, and she had been in Moscow for about 5 years at the time. To me, she knew everything. I was an ignorant, innocent babe in her care, and everything was new to me. She drove me to campus on my first day of work, and I took a deep, appreciative breath of the morning air as we got out of the car. Noticing it, Lydia commented that it sure was quite muggy today. I looked over at her to see if she was kidding. She had to be kidding. This was like a winter morning in Florida, like the day after a cold front just came through. The cold front would bring rain, cooling everything off so that the humidity would drop from its normal drinkable 80-something percent down to something reasonable and crisp. And it would cool down the winter temperatures to 50 or 60-some-odd degrees. But when Lydia said this about it being muggy in Idaho in August, I looked at her out of the corner of my eye, and I really had to laugh to see that she wasn't kidding. So I asked her, what do you think it is, maybe 15% humidity? And she realized, I think in that moment, that my world in Florida was as foreign to her as her world in Idaho was to me. So she smiled and she laughed and said, oh yeah, okay, maybe 10% or so. Lydia introduced me to country living and small towns and winter. She told me about wheat and lentils and seasons and snow tires. She also arranged my travel, selecting seats in the aisle and flights that were cheap but with decent connections. And she wrote itineraries that included where to pick up the rental car, how to navigate to the hotel and to each destination, and how to get back to the airport, and who would be at each meeting, and the background material about the people and the purpose. And as Lydia did this work for me, I learned that she had never traveled very far from home. She had never seen a palm tree, nor Spanish moss, certainly never the Atlantic Ocean. But she had been to Germany, and she played the violin, and she had a degree in communications and husband, and she certainly knew more about nature, including human nature, than the average Jane. But here in Idaho, it was all new to me. I was the stranger in a strange land. For me in Idaho, visiting this new place, see, it felt like visiting even though I was moving here. This was like the best of all travel. It was like childlike wonder that my eyes saw in a new way. I saw the wheat fields, all golden and rippling in waves. Amber waves of grain really existed. And they live here on sumptuous and undulating hills, waves of earth, waves of wheat on waves of dirt. The air, crisp and clear, the sharpest skies this astronomy student has ever seen, covered these broad, deep black skies every August night. So dark were these skies that each meteor caught the eye, and every night I could look through the window and see one or two falling stars before I drifted off to sleep. Coyote calls fascinated me and my dog, scaring us a little, just enough of a scare to liven the senses and spark imagination. Everything was new, and I was a child in it. After just a month, I headed back to Florida to pick up my car and drive it out to Idaho. I flew into Orlando and drove to my old home on the Atlantic coast before I headed out for my cross-country adventure back to Idaho. As usual, Lydia prepared my travel out to Florida, making notes and plans, considering my preferences and needs, to get me to a place that she had never seen and that I knew all too well. But I landed in Florida with new eyes now, with Idaho eyes, with Lydia's eyes. Having begun a discovery of Lydia's world, I somehow took her eyes with me, and I saw my old world with these new eyes, eyes that had never seen the wonders of Florida. With Lydia's eyes, I saw palm trees as fascinating, their naked trunks stretching up to these sharp tufts. No shade from these silly trees, but there was a real majesty and slender grace that I hadn't noticed before. With Lydia's eyes, I saw hibiscus flowers that bloom practically year-round and wondered at the crocus plants, spider plants, mother-in-law tongues, all other kinds of house plants that grow huge and boisterous outside. no frost to cut them back. The Spanish moss made the live oaks look sad, but dreamy. And the bright beeches seemed like picture postcards, but larger and deeper, brighter, bigger, real. Real Florida beaches. With Lydia's eyes, it was a good place. Maybe not a place she or I would choose to live, but a good place. It was a place to discover, to wonder at, to see everything anew, like a child. When I came back and described the trip to Lydia, she looked at me like she was looking at a child, the child I had become. She indulged me, she enjoyed my discoveries, went with me on the virtual trip of my telling. She said she was glad that I took her eyes with me. Travel always awakens the childlike wonder in me. After being in Idaho so long, I sometimes have to remember to look at it, to look for it, and find that wonder by noticing the new things in old places. New things like the frost that appears suddenly one fall evening after a long and scorching summer, during which I no longer wear turtlenecks. Now I wait until November, and sometimes even later. I see the sky new when Orion comes over the horizon for winter, or when Scorpio first shows his red heart each summer. Being from Florida, and with my people back there still, sometimes I can borrow their eyes and see Idaho again for the first time through them. I'm going back to Florida for a family wedding next month, July. I haven't been looking forward to going to Tallahassee in July. My sister says she won't go on any discoveries with me. It's going to be too hot. It already is too hot. And if I insist on walking around on, even at the grotto-like sinkholes or biking to the lighthouse at St. Mark's, she says I'm going to take a book and sit in the car with the air conditioner on. That's the only way she'll take me there. But even if I stay mostly inside, though, there's a unique deep South and old Florida feel about the place. Even though it has all its Walmarts and Outback Steakhouses and Albertsons groceries, I just have to remember to see that uniqueness, to see the sweet tea on the menu, even at McDonald's, see the red Georgia clay along the shoulders of the roads, which the roads themselves are canopied by huge oaks dripping with Spanish moss. I have to see it all new and with wonderment. So, again, I'll just have to take Lydia's eyes with me.
So I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity. Give me your arms for the brokenhearted, the ones that are far beyond my reach. Give me your heart for the ones forgotten. Give me your eyes so I can see. Yeah. Yeah.
Installment number 2. French lessons. By traveling in France, Scott High learned how to become independent even before going off to college. In this installment, Scott reads his essay called French Lessons for Yin Radio.
I love to travel. I've been traveling most of my life, and I spend the most of it traveling with my family. I've traveled to Western Canada, all over France on 2 separate trips, and Florence, Venice, and Rome, Italy. I've also traveled to as many western states and as far east as Georgia and Florida. I love experiencing new things. Being from a small town, there's not a lot of opportunities to experience new things. I can do this while traveling. That's why I enjoy it so much. The best experience I had while traveling was traveling to different countries. On my first trip to France, I was by myself. It was the first time I was traveling without my family. I was with a school group for a week in Paris, and I was supposed to meet a friend who lived in Angers after my school group left me stranded at a hotel. That's when it hit me. I was alone, in a country where I had only 2 years of high school experience in the language. What was I to do? Where was I to go? The only thing on my schedule at the time was to meet my friend who would not be arriving for another 7 hours. I decided I was going to do some sightseeing. It felt great. Being in another country alone with no one to tell me where to go or what to do gave me this freedom I had never felt before at age 15. I kind of felt like Macaulay Culkin in Home Alone, though. The one thing I loved but found to be quite frustrating at times was getting around. A word of advice for travelers who are planning on traveling to France. Do not ask for help in English. If you don't know how to say it in French, you will get nowhere. Having a French teacher, I felt prepared for the best and worst of France. I knew this going into the trip. I learned as much French as possible and found the people of France were very nice to me when I asked them questions in French. Even if what I said was very broken and my accent horrible, they still helped me out. There's this unspoken rule in France that when you travel in their country, they expect you to speak French. They will ignore you if you speak English. This reminds me of some travelers I know who got very angry when people wouldn't help them as they are screaming at them in English and expected the French to speak English back to them. Kind of a double-edged, ironic sword. As I made my way through Paris on my own, I was amazed at people who go on trips and complain about getting around in the cities and complain about the people as if they were vastly different than Americans. If a 15-year-old boy who has never been to France can get around one of Europe's biggest cities on his own, then anyone should be able to do it, right? Wrong. I found out quickly that if I wanted to get anywhere, I must be forced to learn the language and customs. When my friend Magali came to pick me up, we immediately boarded a high-speed train to a town known famous for its 24-hour car race held every year in June, Le Mans 24 Heures, 24 hours. This car race is one of the biggest car races I have ever seen. It makes America's NASCAR look childish. These cars race non-stop for 24 hours, rain or shine. Given the place of the town, you can pretty much count on rain. I was with my friend who had taken me not only to see the race, but accompanied her while she worked. Her job was to drive the race car drivers around to their pit crews. On the start day, I spent most of the day in the stands watching it along with 200,000 other enthusiasts. At night, when Magali started her shift, I found myself with her and the Team Bentley race crew. One of the drivers was looking for my friend, being as I was the only person who spoke English besides the Bentley pit crew and the driver, he asked me to interpret for him. In return, he gave me a flag. Being able to interpret for him, I felt useful for once. While I was with Magali and her family, I was forced to speak French, and only French. They were understanding of the fact that I did not know a lot of French and would help me with my interpretation. I found this to be the most useful thing they taught me. No matter where I would go, I would give it my best shot and speak the language. On my second trip back to France, I was with my family and the same school group I had gone with 2 years prior. I felt 100 times better prepared on this trip. I knew more French, and I felt like Paris well enough to get around on my own. With a high school group, we had rules to follow, though. One night, much to my parents and my teacher's dismay, I decided I was going to avoid the rule and go exploring with my friends. From our second-story hotel room, we tied two blankets together, one end to the balcony, and the other end led down to the street. For fear of being caught, we thought this was the best way to escape. We shimmied down the blankets and onto the midnight streets of Paris. We did not travel far, though. We only traveled about 3 blocks down to this bar we noticed was still open. We ordered some drinks, this is also where I got to experience real French absinthe, and sat outside in the moonlight, soaking it all in. I had no idea that my French teacher saw the bed sheet and caught me red-handed. When we got back from the bar, stumbled into the hotel, our French teacher was reading quietly in the lounge area. She confronted us and sat us down. She had asked us if we had thought we were in danger. I quickly said no, because I felt that I was not in danger, because we knew where we were and how to get back. I felt she did not understand me. She had a right to be mad. We were violating her rules. If something were to happen to any one of us, it would have been on her shoulders. But do I regret it? No. I felt I experienced a part of French culture I would not have experienced otherwise. My French teacher taught me how to speak the language. My friend taught me how to act. For me, it was knowing the difference of the two and how to conduct myself in situations. That is where I figured out the cultural differences and learned to love every minute of traveling.
That was Scott High with French Lessons. He read that essay live last summer while he was interning with Yin Radio. Now, installment number 3 comes from India. I met writer Hasmita Chander over the internet. I was reading her blog and admiring her writing. And so I started talking to her, and she agreed to read some of her writings by phone for Yin Radio. Being almost directly on opposite sides of the world from each other, just arranging the phone call was quite an issue. But we managed. This short piece, via a lot of phone connections, is called Being an Ambassador.
Being an ambassador. The internet, at a glance, seems to be a mass of unknown and hidden people. You can lead an entirely different life online with a new name, a different gender and profession. But this view is only at a glance. When you spend time here, you get to know people. You can tell who's faking, who's real, and you also get to make some good friends. Even in this gigantic network, chances are you won't meet people of many countries, or you may just meet one person from a country other than yours. And this person forms a lasting impression, bam, in your mind. You get an impression of what his country is, what kind of people live there, how they think and feel and behave, all based on your interaction with this one person. You can argue that this is not fair, it's not balanced, it's not right, but it's the truth, it happens. So let's be careful and be our best, especially in our conversations with people from other countries, online or otherwise. You may be having a bad day and shoot off a hasty, rough reply to the message from your new Japanese acquaintance. You think you can always apologize later, if you remember to, but what you wrote has already made an impression. I'm not saying to pretend or be perfect, how boring that would be, but be courteous, be nice, and be yourself too. I don't know how many people I've rubbed the wrong way, but I do know that I've made India a good place for a few people in other countries. It was wonderful to get a mail from an editor I worked with online in the US. He wrote to me saying, India will always be a warm place to me because I have known you. Thanks to my own interactions with such ambassadors on the internet, Malaysia, America, England, Hong Kong, and Australia will always be warm places to me.
That's writer Hasmita Chander via phone from her home in India. And you can meet her online via the internet as well at hasmitachander.com, HASMITACHANDER.com.
Travel so far, well, let me get myself back. We're seeing the old moon walking past my door. He had freedom high, as warm as the sky. Then he beckoned me to his side and said, come, let's go. Freedom born, just you and me. Bring the sun, if you feel you need some warm company.
Now for that inevitable back-to-school question. What did you do during your summer vacation? I asked people around town in Moscow, Idaho, and it led to lots of talk about travel.
Where did you go this summer? Where did you travel to?
Oh, gosh. Well, we didn't have a long summer vacation where we took 2 weeks and went to one place, but we took advantage of some 3- and 4-day weekends, and we went on a wonderful rafting trip on the... I want to say the Rogue River, but that's what I did with Anna in December. And we went on the Grand Ronde.
Is where I bet you went.
On the Grand Ronde. You have a feeling I went there.
I do.
So that was a really nice trip. And we just got back from a trip to the Tri-Cities. We went and saw Dave Matthews in the Gorge. We did a brief backpacking trip with a girlfriend of ours. And that was in a wilderness area near the Salmon River. And otherwise, we spent a lot of our days enjoying Moscow in the summer, which was really great. We did a lot of farmers markets and a lot of community events, fundraisers, and functions like that.
Cool.
And since the summer isn't over, we're planning on doing a canoe trip with our friends and their little baby, and we're not sure where yet, maybe on the Flathead.
Oh.
Yeah.
Cool.
So That was our summer. That's where we went.
That's cool. Tell me also, where do you want to go? And this is a, you know, not this summer, not whenever. What's a travel dream for you?
We definitely have a travel dream. And Tom and I would both really love to go to Italy. And that's been a dream that we've had ever since we started talking about traveling. So we're hoping that we can make that a reality in one or two summers, where we would actually take a month off from work, plan ahead of time, rent out a house, and do some bicycle touring and sightseeing, and that would be a dream. But there's a lot of research that we have to do before we do that, so we still have some work to do. And then a lifetime dream of traveling is we want to see all of the continents and the wonders of the world. So the man-made wonders of the world and the natural wonders of the world, and then also visit every continent is kind of a lifetime travel goal.
That's great.
Yeah, that would be incredible.
Do it.
Yesterday we saw the eighth wonder of the world, which is Grand Coulee Dam. They claim that they're the eighth man-made wonder of the world. I don't know if that's true or not. So, but that was pretty interesting.
Do you know what some of those wonders are at the top of your head? Natural and or man-made?
Yeah. Some are water, you know, water forms. So Niagara Falls is like a gigantic waterfall. And then the Amazon and the Nile, just for their size and capacity of carrying that much water. And then other ones are, you know, your classic, like the pyramids, the Parthenon, most of them ancient Greece and Athens type, either buildings or statues. And then some of the man-made ones would be like the Taj Mahal or some of the, you know, like the bridge, and the California Bridge, Golden Gate Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm, things like that. So, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for asking. It's always fun.
What did you do with your summer vacation?
Huh. My summer vacation's still going.
Good. And what are you going to do? Or what have you done? Where have you gone?
Where have I gone? Well, we went to Saugees, Frank Church and Saugees, went backpacking, been rafting, been in the Oregon coast, been to California, watched my friend do her first half Ironman. What else did I do? I moved.
Moved?
Here.
From?
Eugene.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Wow. Welcome.
Back.
I used to be here. Still welcome back.
Thank you. And actually, the biggest thing I'm doing over my summer vacation is looking for a job.
You want to put a plug on the radio about what kind of job?
If anyone's looking to hire. What kind of job? That's a question of the hour.
What did you do? What did you do? Where'd you go on your summer vacation? Where'd you go?
No, I'm going to put it in her face. She's my friend. I can do this. I know.
She's been hanging with you. Don't you think she's used to being annoyed by now?
Yeah. Do it.
I just know that in April I might be going to Mexico.
Oh, well, that's good.
Yeah.
Is that a dream trip or just a trip you want to do?
It's just a random trip that I've been invited to go on. It's my old boss at a grocery store that I used to work at, her and a couple of friends.
Yeah.
One of them used to be my junior high PE teacher.
Yeah.
They're all going to Mexico, so they invited me to go.
That's cool.
What is your
I want to go.
They also said what happens in Mexico stays in Mexico.
Where did you go this summer during your summer vacation?
I stayed here at One World during summer.
All summer?
All summer long. I went to Boise a couple times back home on vacation and went on a few little trips. Went rafting down the Middle Fork.
Oh, that's a good trip. Mm-hmm. Now the other question, where do you want to go? If you can go anywhere in the world, what's a dream trip for you?
Dream trip for me would be to Japan. Although, I'm terrified of getting lost there because I don't speak any Japanese.
Yeah. Would you go by yourself or would you buffer it by trying to...
I think it'd be fascinating to go by myself because I've never really been on a trip out of the country or on a trip by myself, so... I don't know. Otherwise, I'd like my friends to be there, of course.
Yeah.
Cool.
Thank you. On your summer vacation, did you travel anywhere?
I went to Seattle.
Uh-huh.
I spent 4 days in Seattle at Seattle Pride, and that was my big summer vacation event. My partner and I went over and celebrated and were prideful and had a great, that was kind of our big summer adventure. So.
That's cool. Yeah. Have you ever been before?
It was my second time.
Yeah.
And so
Is it, I mean, I know San Francisco Pride, and it's something.
Right.
And of course, I was at Moscow. Seattle Pride's got to be
It's big. Large. It is very large. And in the past couple of years, they've moved it down to Seattle Center, so it's, you know, a lot bigger than it used to be. It used to just be in Volunteer Park on Capitol Hill, and so it's really taking kind of a centerpiece in for that weekend in Seattle, and it's more of a community event now than just, you know, a pride event. So
cool.
2.5 hour long parade. It's a huge parade and lots of people. So
that's great. Yeah. Tell me one of the big parade things that you remember.
This year it was really political. I would assume because of the elections and everything, very political. But 1400 Rights was one of the big groups that came through, and that's 1400 Rights would be the amount of rights that you get through marriage that LGBT couples are denied of. So I think that was one of the most influential groups that came through. It really caught my eye.
And one other question, follow-up question, is what's your dream trip?
My dream trip?
Anywhere in the world.
I'm going to have to say, I really want to go to Brazil. I've done a little bit of South America, and so I'd really like to go to Brazil and just participate in Carnival and do all that. I think that'd be a really amazing trip and just very culturally unique, and I think that would probably be one of my ultimate dream trips that I could go on.
Thank you.
Where'd you go this summer?
I went to Glacier National Park for a week, and we backpacked around the upper and lower Quartz Lakes. And then I went, will this be too much noise?
Yeah.
And then I went to Alaska and did a 4-day backpacking trip with my mom and sisters on the Resurrection Pass.
Just the women?
Mm-hmm.
That's cool.
Yeah.
That's a rare opportunity. Who'd you go to Glacier with?
With my roommates, my old roommates from college, Meg and Carrie. Also only women.
Wow. And then what did you do for your cap? Since we're on a roll here with this all-women thing.
And then I had an all-women's riding and backpacking trip in the Wallawa Mountains.
Yeah. Do you know, is it different to do the all-women thing versus mixed? Do you know? Different quality to it?
I'd say so.
Yeah.
From my experience.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a different tone of a trip.
Yeah.
I think.
I would think so too.
I'm sure it depends on who you're with.
I'm sure. Yeah.
But.
I was just curious what your take was on it, because I've had some family outings too.
Uh-huh.
All girls. Or uh-huh. Just the girls went. And they're different than when we mix in the guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know how to describe it. But I've never done anything that adventurous, so you have an adventurous group.
Yeah. I do.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Where'd you go for your summer vacation?
Well, I didn't get that much of a summer vacation, but I spent some time up at my family's lake cabin in Coeur d'Alene, on the Coeur d'Alene Lake, and we also, where else did I go? My husband got to go to Italy. So that's really cool, but I didn't get to go. But I did get to, for work, it wasn't vacation, but it sometimes feels like it because I got to do some camping on the South Fork of the Clearwater River.
Oh, that's nice.
So that was really gorgeous, it's so beautiful. If you haven't ever camped down there, gosh, go down there because it's...
Like around where? Around
between Stites and Elk City.
Ah, yeah.
So it's really a gorgeous river in that section of river.
And quite remote.
It is remote, yeah. I had to have done something. Didn't I do something? I really do think that I was pretty adamant with gas prices the way they were to kind of do some staying closer to home. And we actually, when my husband got home from Italy, we did a staycation, and I just didn't come to work, but we did a lot of work on our house. So that was really great. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I spent a lot of time at the family lake cabin. It's just been one of those things that I had known that I wanted to do this year, because Ellis was going to be gone, in Italy, and it's just a close place so that I can take my dogs, and it's a safe place, and you can have a lot of fun and on the dock and just be. So that's what I did. We are planning to go on our winter vacation in Mexico, though.
Oh, good.
We're going to take our honeymoon finally, so I'm really excited.
That's great. Yeah. We're in Mexico.
We're going to Puerto Vallarta. So
that's great.
Yeah.
Do you have any other place on your list of places, any other thing on your list of places you really want to go? I mean, Mexico.
Oh,
maybe,
yeah. Maybe I mean, I want to get to see my friend Tiffany in Santa Barbara.
Oh, yeah.
And to take a yoga retreat there. And then what else do I mean, I, of course, want to do a bunch of really big things. Like, I would love to go and go back to Africa. And I also would like to go to Australia at some point. But
yeah. But back to Africa.
I've been to South Africa, but I want to go to other regions in Africa, just like the northern parts of Africa, because the continent.
What's intriguing about it to you?
Gosh, Africa as a continent is just like they're so melodic, you know. I had a friend that was in Ghana, and another friend of mine. Where was she? Anyway, she just said that she was a teacher at the schools, and the children just, they learn to sing at such a young age and use their voices, and they harmonize together. They're just, I don't know, it just seems like what a cool thing to be able to hear, you know, and to see that culture is so different.
Cool.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
So I done laid around, done stayed around. This old town too long. Summer's almost gone. Winter's coming on. Done laid around, done stayed around. This old town too long. And it seems like I'm gonna travel on.
And while some Americans are considering trips to Africa, some Africans are visiting America. Author Peter Chilson explores the theme of Africa meets America in the American West.
I'm very interested in clashes of culture. And not always clashes, sometimes cultures just meet and cool things happen. But this is just a brief excerpt from an essay I'm working on. It's not published. It's about something that I saw when I was in my hometown in 2002. I grew up in Aspen, Colorado. And I was back there for my mother's funeral in 2002. And one day, to clear my head, I went out cross-country skiing. One morning in 2002, in the last days of winter, I was poling through a bony forest of aspen and fir on a cross-country ski track. I knew would break from the trees and circle miles of meadow. I'd trained and raced on this ground in the 1970s at the base of a mountain outside Aspen, Colorado, where I grew up. Now, after years away, I followed the track across terrain reshaped by many huge new homes. This is a ski town, after all, and it's logical someone would preserve the course. The houses had great picture windows, wraparound decks, outdoor swimming pools, hot tubs, high stone walls and chimneys, and they stood on land that had been for me a vaguely wild place, the domain of bear, deer, coyotes, and in winter of skiers like myself. Sunlight still stumbled through branches, casting bright and fractured stains on snow, just as I remembered. As I came around a corner a few hundred feet through the trees from one home, I heard voices whose intonation sounded like Bambara, a language of West Africa, where I've traveled and worked for many years. I skidded to a stop and listened, peering through the trees at three coal-skinned African men on a deck in parkas and ski caps. One shoveled snow, carefully dumping rather than tossing each load off the deck, while the second man stood beside a blue plastic tub of cleaning liquids and rags set on the deck railing. The third, hands thrust in his jean pockets, sat on a bench and did most of the talking. I realized they were the help. The resort town term is houseboys. And I listened a few minutes, understanding nothing. I don't know Bambara, but I speak French, the language of one of West Africa's former colonial masters. I shouted, "Bonjour!" The men stopped talking and gathered at the edge of the deck to peer back through the woods at me. A tall figure in a blue windbreaker and black ski pants. They said nothing. I waved and shouted, "Assalamu alaikum," an Arabic peace greeting common in the Muslim world, which is to say, throughout West Africa. I hoped they would invite me over, but the men looked at one another, exchanged words, and hurried inside the house. They left the plastic tub on the railing and the shovel lying in the snow. I stared after them, feeling foolish. The men were far from home in a place so different from their dry, impoverished homeland that my greetings must have made them suspicious. Maybe they thought I was an immigration officer. I skied on, touring the meadow and wondering how these men, in search of a better life and means to support families, had managed to leave their desert home and enter a country so increasingly paranoid about its borders. I was curious about the risks they'd taken and how they'd survived. 2 hours later, I returned to that house, hoping to explain myself and welcome the Africans to the Rocky Mountains, where the sun is as dangerous as in the Sahara. But the deck was empty. Fearing trouble with their employer, I didn't knock on the door.
That was Peter Chilson at a reading in Moscow, Idaho, this year. Peter's new book is called Disturbance-Loving Species, a novella and short stories, and it's a collection of stories about Americans in Africa struggling to cope with political and social conflict, and about Africans trying to adjust to life in the United States. Chilson's also the author of Writing the Demon, On the Road in West Africa. He teaches writing and literature at Washington State University, and he lives in Moscow, Idaho, and Portland, Oregon. And from Africa, we go a little further around the globe to New Zealand and another story about where cultures meet. This is from artist June Northcroft Grant, who talks about her family history and her home. Even as the Maori people of New Zealand hold on to their roots, their lifestyles have been changed forever by contact with Europeans. June Grant spent 3 months in the Palouse region of Washington and Idaho as an artist in residence. Installment number 5, and our last installment on today's travel show, June's going to talk about the place, the culture, and the changes in her homeland.
Well, kia ora and welcome. Welcome to this presentation. I'm honored to be here in this area. I thought that it was wonderful just being in the northwest coast city of Olympia, but I've been privileged to be able to have travelled. I've been to New York since I've been here. I've been to Washington to the NMAI, the wonderful museum there, and I've been up all over the, I went up to Nia Bay a couple of weeks ago, and next week I go to Celebration in Juneau, so I'm very, very fortunate. And I've actually seen a lot of places that a lot of local people haven't seen, so I try not to brag about it, but I'm certainly enjoying my time here. And it's the result of a residency that has been running with the Longhouse and the Arts Council in New Zealand. And it's the result of cultural exchanges, and it's so important. And it really changes our art when you look at the art experiences that we have and you see how the artists develop further when they, even years down the track, you'll see how it influences and changes our art. The first word that is here is whanaungatanga, and it means relationships. And we're Polynesian people, and that's very important to us. Polynesian people come from Hawaii, Samoa, Tonga, the Cook Islands, Easter Island, and New Zealand, and Tahiti, of course. We're Polynesian people. Even though New Zealand is really, really close to Australia, Australia and the Aboriginal people of Australia are very, very different to us. They're Melanesian, and they have a religion and a culture that goes back unhindered for over 100,000 years. So they're very profound and very amazing people. It's just that we have a less of a relationship with them because we don't have the same understanding about each other's cultures or art. Polynesians with the Samoans and the Tongans, our art forms are the same, and I can see the art forms similar to the First Nations people here and the Native Americans. The affinity to the earth, the values of the culture are something that we have also. So whanaungatanga is about relationships, and that's why the word is there, it's important. So the proverb is, kia uki tō kawai tupuna, kia mautauria ai ahu mai koe ihia, e anga koe ko hea, which is a Maori proverb, which means, it means trace out your ancestral stem so that it be known where you come from and in which direction you are going. And that's an important point about how we introduce ourselves in terms of who we are. If we encounter Maori in different places, they will ask, where are you from, rather than who are you? We always identify ourselves by our mountains, and this is the mountain of my tribal area. I live on a volcanic plateau in the centre of the North Island of New Zealand. My tribal area runs from the coast on the east coast to the central North Island plateau. And this is one of the mountains, and it's called Tarawera. And in 1886, my tribe lived by the side of this beautiful lake and this mountain. On the side of the mountain, there was beautiful silica terraces that ran up the side of the mountain. There were white terraces and pink terraces, and they were called the eighth wonder of the world. We had lots of visitors from England that would come in 1885 and for those years preceding the eruption to view these mountains and the terraces. But you had to be wealthy because you had to pay a tribal member to take you across the lake by canoe. And the tribe was becoming quite wealthy, really. And the old shaman, we call them tohunga, high priests, medicine men, were sort of shaking their heads and saying, this does not augur well for the future of our people. You're being seduced by money and other things. So they predicted that something terrible was going to happen. And in the days preceding the 8th of June 1886, they had noticed that the water levels in the lake were rising and falling. And one of our grandmothers, she was taking a canoe load of visitors across the lake in the canoe. And they noticed that in the distance there was a war canoe on the lake, and the war canoes hadn't been on the lakes for a number of years because we were tribal people and we were itinerant and warring. So even amongst our own tribes we would battle, and as they did all down the coast here. But we'd been peaceful for a number of years. And they noticed the war canoe, and they noticed that there were warriors rowing this canoe, but as it came closer, the heads of the warriors turned into dogs, and they went, oh, thinking it was a theatrical performance. Now, the interesting thing about this is that as Maori people, we know that these things happen and these visions take place, but it was a canoe full of English tourists, and they saw the whole thing, you know, as if it was a theatrical play. So it was written up about in the newspapers. This canoe had been seen on the lake, and then it disappeared. Well, of course, 3 nights later, they knew why all these things were happening, because the mountain blew to smithereens and it devastated. It looked like Mount St. Helens when I looked at all the photos of after, you know, and everybody knew that Mount St. Helens was going to blow up too, but there were people saying, I'm not moving, I'm staying here. Well, our people stayed there too, and it devastated the tribe, and we lost a lot of people, but there were a number that were saved in this little house, this little whare. The whare is the name of the meeting house. Whare means house. And this little house that was looked after by Sophia, who was the guide, she saved 136 people. They held up the roof from the ashes with their hands, and she saved 136 people. So the young lady that was here has been to Rotorua, and one of the things that they remember is the smell, because it's a geothermal area, and it smells like Yellowstone Park, you know, the geothermal sulfur. The sulfur smell, which is like rotten eggs. So a lot of people tell me that when they're approaching by bus, they're sort of looking at their companions thinking, oh, what's going on here? So this is my lake. So you identify with our mountains and our lakes. Now, my tribe, we're always identified by our tribe. Our tribe is identified by the name of our canoe, and my canoe was called Te Arawa. So when I say I'm Te Arawa, this is my mountain, this is my lake, I'm Te Arawa, and this is my sub-tribe. This is an image that is a typical image of our traditional art forms. Mostly they were carved in abstract, stylized figurative study, and you'll see these in our meeting houses now. Around my lake, there are 42 fully carved meeting houses. So that's like 42 reservations around the lake where people dwell. This is the tribal village that I'm from. I'm literally from this village. The three houses that you see on the left-hand side here are houses that belong to my family. There are two houses, the traditional house and the kitchen area and the dining area. This is a new house, but there were three houses in the line belonging to three grandmothers. There's the Catholic church, and these are the pools that we use for cooking food, and these are the pools that we have for bathing, which is completely separate. The tribe still lives there today in this village. It's a bit of a goldfish bowl because you have visitors visiting the village from 6 o'clock in the morning till 10 o'clock at night. And they can walk into the houses, especially when they don't understand the language. So we have a lot of foreign people getting growled and told off because they don't read the sign which says private. And there is the famous Pōhutu Geyser, and it's like Old Faithful in Yellowstone Park. It used to play regularly, and the geothermal resources were failing in that area. So they closed off all the bores that were used to heat the homes in a 1 mile radius from the geothermal field, and the geothermal activity came back. This house here where my cousin lives, and there's this huge big cavernous hole underneath this part of this house here, and it's got a boiling mud pool in it, but Arthur doesn't seem to worry. He said, oh, we've been here for 100 years, you know. What else can happen? But the village is called Te Waka Wera Wera Tango Te Opatawa Awahiao, but we just call it Waka. And this is the tribal meeting house. This is the meeting house where we celebrate all our tribal functions. Only the Maori language is spoken, which is why it's helped to preserve our language. There is only one language spoken in New Zealand. It's the same language. We have dialectal differences, but it means our rituals of encounter and our culture is the same everywhere we go. See, I spoke earlier about how religion came to New Zealand soon after colonisation, because the missionaries thought they were going to convert all these native people into big, great citizens. And so we had the Catholic missionaries came out, and of course all the Presbyterians, Methodists, Anglicans, Jehovah's Witness, Mormon, the whole gamut of religions are all in New Zealand. So we practice all of those in the meeting house. So at one stage the chief came out of the marae and said, we're going to make a decision today about whether we're Anglican or Catholic. So everybody on the right-hand side of the par is Anglican, and the people on the left-hand side are Catholic. And so we have a Catholic church on that, which you saw in the previous picture, on one side of this meeting house, and everybody else. But people cross over and change and go to all sorts of services, and it's not really a problem. The name of the marae is Wahiao. Now, these are the people I belong to. These are we're canoe people. So we have large regattas with large war canoes. Well, they're not war canoes anymore, but they're large enough that three men have to organise the steering of it. The guy in front, the guy in the middle, and the guy at the back. To sort of, you have to shout the directions to say which way to pull, and so that the boat's on an even keel. So we're canoe people. These are typical women of my tribe. Now, the interesting thing about these women is that there's been a renaissance of our art forms, and one of the art forms was the art of tā moko, and tā moko is what you would know as tattoo. It's from a Tahitian word, which is tatou, and it's a derivation of that. So tattoo became unpopular because the number of people that acquired it were the ones who came from mostly England, and they would visit these Tahitian and Polynesian cities. They were whalers and sealers. They would call in to get fresh fruit and vegetables from the islands. They liked the idea of having these markings on their bodies, so they would get marked, tattoos. They'd go back to England, and then they were the ones that were drunk or hung out at the wharfs, and so there was a whole connotation of, you know, not nice people have those things on their bodies. So for generations, which sort of stuck in my head too. I would never get a tattoo, you know, because of the connotations, which was ridiculous. It's what you grow up with. By contrast, all my children have. And you see, tribally, a lot of people totally and fully tattooed in an appropriate tribal and ritual way. So all these women here have the kauai moko on their chin. Kauai, and it's usually a pattern of an owl, and the owl is the wisdom, and that's what that represents. Now, these are the warriors who, if you've ever seen a haka being performed, a haka is a tribal war dance, and it's a dance designed to hype the men up before they go into battle. It's actually quite a challenging sort of a dance, because it looks, they're half naked for a start, and they have protruding tongues. You can't see that in the... But to see a war dance is actually quite exciting. And if you come to New Zealand, you will see it. You will see, as part of cultural activities, they show you the dances of the Maori people, and this is one of them. So this is one of the people from my tribal area, and he's just a normal guy. He's just sort of, when I say normal, he's a normal dad with all these children and his hunting dog. But he's decided to get the full-face moko, which is really quite unusual. And that's what he looks like in his regalia. So he changes from the guy next door to this noble chief. And so he's made a commitment to that. So there are a lot of people who have made the commitment to this full facial. And they had, our chiefs were all mokoed in this way. Oh, this is what this is me, believe it or not. This is when I was 18. And my kids go, "Mum, you had such long legs." And I say, "Well, they're still the same length," which they are. But this was I put this in here because it's about it's about, you know, me being the same. My grandmother Maggie Papakura was a great mentor to me, even though she passed away when she was quite young. And so I realised later that I'd passed all the things that she had done in her life, I was doing in mine too. And so I was a model and on postcards when I was a young woman as well. But this was in 1968 when a photographer would say, "Well, this is you're a Maori-looking girl, and that you're the sort of person that we need to have on the postcard," when I wasn't necessarily very Maori-looking, and they chose to illustrate, you know, and set me in positions that this is actually quite revealing, considering. So I'd never let my children pose like this probably now, because it's just not appropriate. I mean, it's fine. There's nothing awful about it, but it's sort of like, that's not how we look. This is not how we would, you know, conduct ourselves in a normal tribal setting. So we're changing how, you know, it's like filmmaking, and we don't look like that normally on the films. You've changed us to look like somebody else. So, as I say, it was a long time ago.
When cultures meet, things change. To see the postcard of June Grant and photos of her art that is inspired by tradition, you can contact me at sandyb@yinradio.org. Thanks for joining me for this Yin Radio show about traveling and finding out that it's not such a lonely planet after all. You can contact Yin Radio at Yin Radio, Y-I-N Radio, at vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org, or give a call to 208-882-1626. For today's show, I'd like to thank Scott High, Hasmita Chander, Peter Chilson, and June Grant. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, by VP Foundation. Thanks so much for joining me. Until next week.